The following is a rebroadcast of a previously aired program.
From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome everyone to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
A headache can upend your day and take you off your game, but a dose of aspirin or acetaminophen usually takes care of it. But other headaches, like migraines, that's a different story.
It reaches a level of moderate intensity so that it makes it difficult for you to function normally. And it's accompanied by nausea, sometimes vomiting, and or light and sound sensitivity. It tends to worsen even with routine activities.
Also on the program, the Ebola epidemic in West Africa took thousands of lives and frightened the world. Now that it's officially over, we'll hear about what we've learned and what could help prevent another outbreak.
And newborns at home. Tips for caring for your new baby and for yourself.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Well, headaches, Tracy, they come with more names than you might imagine for such a common medical condition. There's cluster headaches, an external compression headache, cough headache, rebound headache, sinus headache.
Ooh, the worst.
Sex headache. That's the not-tonight, dear, headache.
Oh, my goodness.
The ice cream headache. And, of course, migraine headache. And that's only a partial list, but actually I'm out of breath.
Well, I'll take over.
All right.
For most of us, a headache prompts us to reach for some aspirin or some acetaminophen, and in a few hours we'll feel better. But for some, headaches can signal a serious underlying medical problem. Here to fill us in on the different kinds of headaches, what causes them, and what they might be signaling is Mayo Clinic neurologist Dr. Michael Couture. Welcome to the program, Dr. Couture. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Thanks. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks.
I guess the question is, where do we start? This is there's so many different kinds of headaches, and this is such a common problem.
Well, in the course of their lives, probably over 90% of the population have a headache. The most common ones are probably sort of mild, benign problems that crop up and can be handled with simple analgesics. But the people that wind up seeing us have recurrent headaches that increasingly interfere with their lives and make it difficult to have a job or take care of their family. The headaches happen as a result of a system that we all are built with. It's a system put in place to protect our brain. It's sort of the burglar alarm to protect our brain. So when appropriately activated by, you know, a little too much alcohol the night before or not getting enough sleep or missing a meal, it's an appropriate sort of alarm system that, hey, the brain is in peril, or if you've had a head injury, it's quite appropriate. But for the patients that have it day in and day out, it ceases to be an adaptive response and becomes a big problem to function on a day-to-day basis. So those are the people that we end up taking care of. The most common type of headache that brings people into the office are those disabling headaches that we call migraine. But we see a whole host of other headaches caused by various things. Just about anything that can perturb the nervous system can result in a headache.
So when your brain hurts, you have a headache, your brain is telling you something.
The brain itself doesn't hurt, but the supporting structures around it, the meninges and the blood vessels that supply the blood supply to the brain, give the blood flow to the brain, are exquisitely innervated with pain fibers, so that anything that is in the neighborhood and might potentially injure the brain can cause this activation of these pain fibers and result in a headache.
The most common headaches, maybe, I would say luckily, for a majority of people are things like you said, you know, too much alcohol or not enough sleep or you skipped a meal. When I always just was thinking, my kids will say, I have a headache, and I'll say, drink a glass of water. I mean, what is the main thing that gives people a headache? Is it a lack of sleep or food, or what is it?
It depends on the individual, but those are very common causes. Very common causes. Fatigue, exposure to little febrile illnesses often bring a headache as a part of the syndrome. But those are generally benign, short-lived, and they don't happen again and again. And when they start to happen a few days a week, then you know there's something else probably going on.
Do we know what actually is going on in the brain while you're having a headache?
Oh, well, there's a whole circuitry that's activated when you have a headache. Generally, when those fibers even either in the meninges or in the blood vessels are activated. They send their depolarization in through an area in the brainstem called the nucleus caudalis, the trigeminal nucleus caudalis. Then there is it's projected onto different parts of the brain where various aspects of the headache are mediated. There are parts of the brain that tell you, oh, it's my head that's hurting and not my foot that's hurting, or it's the right side of my head that's hurting or not the left. It's also gives us the emotional response to the head pain. That's a big part of it, as your autonomic nervous system is activated and your limbic system is activated. So it's quite a complex process for such a seemingly simple thing that we all experience.
Yeah, too complex for probably most of us to understand. But the meninges are like the saran wrap around the brain.
That's correct. It's a fibrous covering that lines the skull. And inside that, the brain sort of floats in cerebrospinal fluid. It's sort of a shock absorber and cleaning system for the brain.
Do you have a recommendation with regard to what medication tends to work best for the common everyday headache? What over-the-counter medication? There are obviously several available.
Probably the most effective would be like a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication like an ibuprofen or a naproxen. We use quite a bit of those. If used too often, though, they increase the acidity in your stomach and make it difficult to use, so you create new problems. Acetaminophen does not do that quite so often, but and can be quite effective for mild to moderate headaches, but typically those that are moderate to severe require like a non-steroidal treatment.
You mentioned the shock absorber part of the meninges. Is that what it's called?
Well, it's actually the spinal fluid.
Oh, the spinal fluid.
So
okay.
It's floating inside there. So if you stop suddenly, your brain doesn't crash into the front of your skull. It sort of floats
thing.
Into
yeah.
the front of your skull.
And that's what we're learning more about. You know, as we learn more about concussions or traumatic brain injuries, what about when it's not, you know, sleep or food or alcohol that caused the headache, but that you did actually hit your head?
Right.
How does your head respond differently to that type of a headache pain?
No, it's the same old response. It's actually one of those instances in which the activation of the system is appropriate because it's warning you of potential or even warning you that you have had some injury to your brain.
You mentioned that 90% of people at one time or another are going to have a headache. It's sort of like back pain, isn't it?
Correct.
The orthopedists see back pain, you see people with
It's the same process, different part of your body.
Who's at risk? Are there certain people who are more likely to get headaches than others?
Yes, believe it or not, there are people in the population who go through their whole lives and never have a headache.
Isn't that great?
And to a large extent, that is probably genetically determined. A whole swath of the population, however, is highly prone to headaches, and sometimes from childhood onward they struggle. It often, in those individuals, ends up manifesting itself as something like migraine.
What about headaches in children? Not very common, right?
No.
And are they reason for concern if they occur frequently?
Actually, they're fairly common in children. And if they're accompanied by neurological symptoms, could possibly be some cause for concern.
And when you say neurologic symptoms, like what would be an example?
Abnormal ability to walk, alteration in consciousness, the appearance of seizures, because in very young children, sometimes that can warn of some sort of a structural cause. As it can at any point in a person's life, but when compared to the benign primary headache disorders, it's very uncommon. In very young children, though, you pay more attention.
Okay, so in young children, if they had some sort of deficit associated with it or something associated with the headache, that would be a reason to see a physician.
Absolutely.
What about in an adult? When at what point in time, with regard to headaches and frequency, severity, should they think about seeing a
physician?
Well,
the decades of life in which you have the high occurrence of these benign, when I say benign, meaning that it's not life-threatening, ultimately, they're not so benign when you're having them. The decades of life when you have these primary headache disorders, it begins in early adolescence and in the 20s, 30s, 40s, quite prominent. And the relative occurrence of a headache driven by, say, a brain tumor or an aneurysm or some ominous cause is very, very small. The percentage is very, very small. As we age, after the age of 60, the appearance of a new headache in a person through the course of their life who has not really had very many headaches, that becomes a little more cause for some further investigation, we typically will be more prone to image these individuals, because the decades of life that it disappears and is most prominent is probably in the late teens, early 20s, and the 30s. So we don't worry so much when an adult appears with a headache, especially if they have the characteristics that are suggestive of a known syndrome. But before the age of 6 and after the age of 60, we pay more attention.
We're talking about headaches with Mayo Clinic neurologist Dr. Michael Couturier. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, myth or matter of fact.
Migraines can begin at any age, though most people have their first migraine during adolescence. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Our guest is neurologist and headache expert Dr. Michael Couturier. We've talked in general about headaches, that they involve 90% of the population. Most of them are benign. The ones that might be a little bit worrisome are in children less than age 6 and adults over the age of 60, if you've never had a problem with headaches before. We've talked somewhat about the risk factors, and we wanted to ask a couple of questions about risk factors, and that was about withdrawal from caffeine, that kind of headache.
Very common. Caffeine actually tends to suppress headaches, but when your body has a constant supply of it and you are abstinent and you sleep late on Saturday morning and don't have your morning coffee, it's not uncommon to awaken with a pressure-like sensation across the front of your head. Now, in the person who's not really headache-prone, that's not such a problem. It's something that you reach for the cup of coffee or an aspirin and it goes away. People who have a tendency toward migraine or other more severe disorders, it acts as a blasting cap in their keg of dynamite, pushing them down the road to that migraine headache. So we tend to counsel our patients who are prone to headaches to avoid frequent high usage of caffeine.
And what about the other kind of headache I wanted to ask, be sure and ask you about, was stress or tension headaches. Pretty common.
This term stress headache is kind of complicated. The actual definition of a tension type headache is basically the opposite of migraine. Basically, it's a pressure-like headache that is of mild to moderate intensity that is not associated with any of the migraine features like nausea or vomiting or lighter sound sensitivity. It's kind of that mild, nondescript headache that most people experience from time to time. Now, for years, we assumed that it was associated with environmental stress, but in fact, can occur very often in the absence of stress. And stress causes all kinds of headaches. It's anything that perturbs your nervous system can generate a headache. So that mild kind of headache is pretty nonspecific and shouldn't be always assumed to be related to stress.
Well, we wish all headaches were benign, but they're not, are they? Let's talk about the big M.
Yeah, the migraines. We'll start with myth or matter of fact. Migraines can begin at any age. Is that a myth or is that a fact?
Can begin at any age. I have patients who report the beginning, their first attack, 5-6 years old. Mm.
If you've never had a migraine and you just have had a really bad headache, what is it that makes it a migraine? How does it pull it into that category?
Well, typically untreated, a migraine attack will last at least 4 hours. It reaches a level of moderate intensity so that it makes it difficult for you to function normally. And it's accompanied by nausea, sometimes vomiting, and or light and sound sensitivity.
In the eyes.
In the eyes.
Yeah. So Do you get a headache in your eyes, too?
Oh, it's not in the eyeball itself, but it's in the orbit where the eyes sit, where a lot of the pain is. You can also tell a migraine. It tends to worsen even with routine activities. If you try to do normal activities, walking up downstairs, it makes the intensity of the pain worse.
With regard to what's going on inside the brain, is it the same as the everyday headache, only just 100 times worse, more intense?
In some sense, yes. Typically, the other types of headaches are not associated with the transient focal neurologic symptoms that we call the aura that pretty well pegs it as a migraine. If you experience a blind spot in your vision before the onset or numbness in your face and hand, or you have a period where you can't speak, those are all associated with migraine in about a third of people who get migraine attacks.
Do we know what causes the migraine headache?
I think that for the majority of people, it's inherited in their families. You can blame mom and dad. It can be acquired, I suspect, in many instances by head trauma or some other injury. But for most people, It can be traced in their family back generations.
Is a migraine the same as a cluster headache?
No, it's a quite distinct syndrome. A cluster headache is a unilateral, extremely severe headache that occurs around the eye. The attacks themselves are shorter. They last about 15 minutes, typically to about an hour, but as long as 3 hours. And during that 3 hours, it's as if a hot poker is being stabbed in your eye. Your eye gets red and swells, your nose runs, you sweat on your forehead on the side of the pain. It is an extremely severe headache disorder that has been compared in its level of intensity to childbirth and a kidney stone.
Oh my goodness.
Don't want one of those.
No.
So with regard to diagnosis of these two conditions, severe type headache conditions, the cluster headache and the migraine, can you make the diagnosis by history alone, or are there other tests that you do to confirm it? Or
in general, the history is made on the basis of the description of the individual acute attack. The duration of a cluster headache is 3 hours or less. Migraine is 4 hours or more. Cluster headache is not associated with the nausea and the light sound sensitivity. Migraine is. Patients with migraine want to retreat back into a quiet room, not have any sensory input. Cluster headache patients are up pacing, hitting the wall, quite agitated.
All right, what we all want to know is we know that migraines have been notoriously difficult to treat, but it's my understanding that you've got some new drugs, some new ways to prevent migraines.
Migraine is complicated. Yeah. It probably is based on complex genetics, meaning that thing that's not exactly right is not the same thing in everybody or every family. Mm-hmm. And the kind of treatment that you respond to as a preventative is related to the underlying biological cause, the driver. Every medicine that we have that works as a migraine preventative was found fortuitously when people were given these medicines for another disorder.
Right.
And we, at this point, don't have a biological rationale on how to give what medicine to what person to be able to predict what's going to work. So it ends up being these series of trials. There are some new things on the horizon. I think you were probably referring to the new CGRP antibody, the biological that I'm hoping will be available to us in the next couple of years. It is built to either bind to the CGRP molecule, which has been associated with migraine, or to the receptor, and we have quite favorable preliminary information about its ability to prevent migraine.
But in general, you're able to prevent a significant percentage of migraines. Today,
correct.
Right?
Of the patients that we see, I would say probably up to 80%, we can substantially reduce the frequency of their headaches.
That's pretty encouraging, isn't it?
Because Dr. Shives mentioned it at the beginning and I kind of raised my eyebrows about that, a sex headache. I have to just ask.
That's its own specific kind of headache.
Who really experience headaches during sex?
Yes, yes. And it's a disorder that we see from time to time. A small percentage of those people have an unruptured aneurysm. So whenever someone presents with that history, we'll always check them for that. But it's a small percentage. But there is this primary disorder, meaning that there is not a known cause, where just as you approach orgasm, mm-hmm. you have an explosive headache, almost like what people experience with a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Very severe. It certainly destroys the moment.
Men as well as women have this?
Men as well as women.
Wow. Well, thanks, Dr. Couture, for sharing your insights and advice about headaches. Dr. Michael Couture is a neurologist at Mayo Clinic. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is officially over. We'll hear what scientists have learned from it that could help in fighting the next outbreak.
And having a new baby can be a joy and a challenge. We'll have some suggestions on handling those first few weeks of newborn care. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. This dog, Old Cooper, is good for his owner's health.
And there are overwhelming data. When you hold a cat, when you groom a horse, when you pet a dog, there is a surge of feel-good hormones that we can measure. Prolactin, oxytocin, and dopamine.
Mayo Clinic oncologist Dr. Edward Cragen says owning a pet also boosts your immune system.
That your immune system becomes more robust, more infection-fighting, when you have that reason to live in your life.
Pets have other health benefits too. The CDC says they may lower blood pressure, cholesterol, triglycerides, and feelings of loneliness. Pets give you a reason to get up and get moving. Dr. Cragen has a saying, it's get pets, not pills, because pets can help improve your mental and physical health. I'm Vivian Williams, and for more health news, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Tracy McRae. It was just about a year ago that the massive Ebola virus outbreak that affected several African countries appeared to have peaked. Throughout much of the preceding year of 2014, the number of cases had grown exponentially and many thousands of people had died. The fear of Ebola swept across the globe and many countries, including the U.S., began preparing for possible outbreaks within their borders. Now, a year or more later, the West African Ebola outbreak seems to have run its course. Scientists following the epidemic have marked what they call the two incubation periods since the last case related to the latest epidemic. But that doesn't mean that Ebola has been eradicated. There will likely be more cases. And here to bring us up to date on the Ebola situation is Mayo Clinic infectious disease specialist and frequent guest, Dr. Pratish Tosh. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Because of Ebola, that's the first time that I ever met you, that you came on the radio show to talk to us about Ebola.
Well, you're welcome, I guess.
What is the situation with Ebola at this point?
So thankfully, and we are cautiously optimistic, that since we haven't seen any cases in the last 42 days in any of the previously affected West African countries, that this is really the first time since really March of 2014 that we haven't had any cases. Now, this is really great news.
Right.
Sort of stopping the cycle of transmission. I do want the public, however, to know that we are likely to still see sporadic cases coming up. So we've had over 28,000 people who are infected, over 11,000 have died, but that does leave a lot of survivors, which is great. Well, we do know that this virus can remain latent for a few months, and usually remains latent in what we call immunologic sanctuaries, the eyes, but also semen. And for a few months.
Wow. And so
people can unfortunately transmit, and obviously people are told, if you're a survivor, you really should be abstaining from sex until we're certain that the virus is gone from the semen. However, because of these immunologic sanctuaries and the potential for latency, there may be sporadic cases that come up even within these West African countries. Now, that should not start panic, right? That, oh, I thought this was gone. Mm-hmm. We're kind of expecting this to happen for the next couple of months to a couple of years. We've learned a lot as an international community that the world is getting a lot smaller.
What I remember you saying, again, almost 2 years ago, and then again last year, when it started to kind of cross the ocean and arrive in this country and people started getting completely freaked out, is that kind of my takeaway from our conversations where the real story is the lack of infrastructure and healthcare in these countries.
That's exactly right.
So that is what the World Health Organization was really trying to. That's another fire they're trying to put out in addition to trying to treat that outbreak at the time.
Yeah, I think we've learned a lot in that these previously isolated areas where if something happened there, it's probably not going to affect the rest of the world. Well, that's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. Because of commerce and international travel, something that happens in a very remote part of the world can very much impact the rest of the world and even here in the United States. And so it is incumbent upon us in the industrialized world to actually help these developing countries to develop their public health infrastructure so that they have running water, flushing toilets.
Clean water.
Yeah, clean water, vaccinations, these sort of things, which will help those countries, but also prevent these infections from coming into our own country, if that is what is needed to drive this. When we see further sporadic cases, I would expect them to be very quickly contained. You'd be able to identify all of the people who are potentially exposed, make sure that they're in quarantined or really observed. Of course, now we have experimental vaccines that we're using in people who have been exposed. And so I would expect whatever sporadic cases that we see be very quickly contained. And so I'm trying to sort of squash whatever preemptively squash whatever panic may ensue when we do see resurgent cases. One other thing is it does come up from the zoonotic reservoir seems to be the bats, which may infect monkeys and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And so that zoonotic reservoir is not gone. And mm-hmm. so we may still see sporadic cases in Africa coming from the zoonotic reservoir.
All right. You, of course, keeping track of infectious diseases, and that's what you do with Mayo Clinic. And there's more than Ebola to worry about. I'm sure that in your workday, that's probably a small percentage of the time that you spend. But there's a couple of other things that I need to ask you about, because speaking of this country, there is now dengue fever in Hawaii.
Yes.
And I don't know what that is, but it can't be good.
Well, the other name for dengue fever is bone break fever.
Oh, Lord.
Which actually sounds like exactly what it does. It makes people feel awful.
That's more of a scary name than dengue fever.
Right, right. Why don't we just call it bone break fever?
Bone break fever. I'm going to change it to that.
Right. So people feel awful. High fevers, muscle ache, bone pains, these sort of things. And some people very well die. Mm-hmm. Now, dengue is not endemic in Hawaii. However, there have been outbreaks before. For example, I think in 2011 there was one on the island of Oahu, and that outbreak was 4 people. Hmm. This outbreak, we're talking about over 200, and this is on the big island of Hawaii. And what usually happens is somebody who is infected with dengue goes, gets bitten by a mosquito, and then you have this cycle of transmission. It is not transmitted person to person. You really do need that vector.
It's a mosquito bite that does it.
It is a mosquito bite. Mm-hmm. And so then it gets from someone infected person to an uninfected person. And then if they get a mosquito bite while they're sick or things like that, and you can sort of propagate the infection. And so what people are doing now is anyone who has been infected, making sure they're getting health care and things like that, and helping them, but also keeping them away from mosquitoes.
Sure.
And you know, so this is preventable mm-hmm. in that somebody who's going to Hawaii for vacation, and they should continue to go
yes.
to Hawaii for vacation. And all they have to do is just make sure that they are taking proper precautions if they're going to go into mosquito areas. And so insect repellent that contain at least 25% DEET, putting it on multiple times a day. If you're really into sort of the thick of it, into the wilderness, mm-hmm. And really into mosquito territory, really think about sleeping under a mosquito net.
Gotcha.
Or if you're going to be out in it, putting on permethrin-laden clothing. But the big thing is this is preventable by preventing mosquito bites.
Gotcha. What about the Zika virus? That was in South America. I'm sure it probably still is, but you said that a case of it popped up in Dallas?
Yeah. Now, this was an imported case, somebody who had traveled.
Sure. Is that mosquito also?
Also mosquito-borne.
Oh, and I hate those mosquitoes.
So it turns out the mosquitoes are actually result in the animal that results in the most human deaths in the world. Yeah. I think deer in the United States just because of vehicle collision, but worldwide because of malaria, because of dengue, because of chikungunya virus, maybe even because of
mosquitoes.
Right.
Does Zika virus make you feel like you've got bones that want to break, or what is that like?
It so most people get Zika virus infection actually don't feel anything, they feel just fine. Maybe 20% develop fever and some of these muscle aches and things like that. The concern, however, is that if it infects a pregnant woman, especially later in their pregnancy, mm-hmm. it can result in birth defects, microcephaly, sort of small brain sort of things. And the evidence really linking this is emerging. And so, but likely there is a link. And we're finding this more out in places that have more infections, such as Brazil. But it's concerning when we start talking about unborn children, mm-hmm. right? That can have birth defects as a result of an infection. We've seen this before with cytomegalovirus, CMV, and also rubella, which we were, thankfully able to sort of kick to the side because of vaccination. Of course, now our vaccine rates are declining, and we may very well start to see a resurgence of rubella disease. But this is why we're concerned about Zika virus.
And the good news of our conversation, because we're almost out of time, is that a flu update is the fourth thing on my list. So it's been a good flu season so far.
It's been a slow flu season so
far. That's good.
With a few interesting twists and turns. And early on, things have been fairly late. The viruses we were seeing was that influenza A, H3N2, all that people need to know is that it tends to be more aggressive. And that's what we saw last year. And the strain that circulated did not match well with the vaccine strain. This year, early on, we were seeing this H3N2 strain that was contained in the vaccine. But in the last few weeks, actually starting to see more H1N1 infections as the epidemic starts to increase throughout the country. So it's likely, I think, to be another H1N1 year. It is contained within the vaccine.
Is it too late to get a flu shot?
It is not too late to get a flu shot.
Wonderful. In fact,
right now would be a great time to get it as the epidemic is starting to come up.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tosh, for the latest on the Ebola virus, dengue fever, Zika virus, and a flu update.
All right. Thank you very much.
Dr. Pratish Tosh is an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, tips on newborn care for both babies and parents. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
A newborn baby in the house. Do you remember?
I do. Seems like it was just yesterday.
But talk about a whirlwind of activity, right? Huh? At first, newborn health might seem limited to round-the-clock feeding, bathing, diapering, soothing. But you know what? There's more to newborn health than just the basics. Other newborn health issues include caring for your newborn's skin, decoding your newborn's cries, and promoting your newborn's development.
Joining us in the studio to talk about newborn care is Mayo Clinic Family Medicine Specialist, Dr. Summer Allen. Welcome to the program, Dr. Allen. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Our news director has a new baby at his house. He and his wife had their third baby, and he said you have to have Dr. Allen to talk about what has changed with taking care of newborns, because this baby is their third, and he said even as the three babies have come along, things have changed in newborn care. And I noticed that was just with my two, that it was different between the two. So what has changed with taking care of newborns?
What changes is, you know, again, our knowledge over time, our ability to observe, you know, different concerns and different things that have happened. One of the events that I noticed with a family that I cared for who had kiddos ranging from 18 years old to when they came to see me for a newborn, and when we talked about sudden infant death syndrome, so SIDS, and how to reduce that, and I explained to them that the recommendations were to lie an infant on their back to sleep, and they looked at me and they said, well, first it was on their stomach, then it was on their side, and now it's on their back. And
yeah.
Again, and fair, in all fairness, and they're right, it had evolved and changed. And I explained to them what was the best available evidence we had at this time, and also different factors that we've identified, like having a non-smoking home. There's also some literature supporting the use of a pacifier in those cases may reduce that incidence of SIDS. So, you know, lying an infant, that's one of the things we talk to parents before they go home, is to make sure that their infants are on a flat, firm surface, lying on their back, and to be careful about any loose blankets, loose stuffed animals, or also the bumpers in the cribs. They've invented the kind of mesh ones or opening ones instead of those nice, comfy bumpers that most of us probably as kids had that our parents put in a crib. And it was to prevent a kiddo that might scoot or roll against it and then be able to become suffocated, unfortunately.
So that has changed.
It has.
That is, the grandma's going to be standing there saying, tuck that baby in, you know, get the bumpers. That's all changed.
That has, and it was interesting for one of the others was that, and you'll see a lot of grandparents do it and parents where they will take the child when they're born or that infant and they'll tuck their arms by the side and they'll do that, we call a little baby burrito, and wrap them tightly in that blanket. And actually for infants, and if you look at them in ultrasound, which I often see during their prenatal care, and in things, the kids have their little hands right by their face, and that provides them comfort. So you're actually causing stress to that child and making that infant nervous when you tuck their arms and don't let them put their hands by their face. So we really encourage parents when they kind of swaddle them or tuck them tight to leave their hands by their face and actually to be careful about those little mittens, even though people want to use it so they don't scratch their face. They like to have their fingers. They want to be able to put it by their mouth or, and again, to try to mimic what was going on for them when they were in the womb.
Did I hear you say that kids who are in households where the mom or the dad, where there's smoke, have an increased risk for sudden infant death syndrome?
There has been some literature out there that to suggest that, yes. So that's why, and again, it among many other factors that all of us would encourage our patients to avoid smoking, and particularly not to smoke around their infant child or in the home, there has been some literature that has supported having a non-smoking home will reduce the incidence of SIDS.
What about breastfeeding? Where do you, are you a big proponent or?
Great question. So there's a big movement to a kind of baby friendly and to encourage breastfeeding. And here's where, and some of my patients will share sometimes that I have my soapbox regarding it. I think that providing moms the opportunity when breastfeeding is their choice and what they want to do, and providing them the support and resources to allow them to be successful, I think that's extremely important and something that we can all do to support them. Understandably, and as I've seen different articles, had patients and reviewed things, there are some people who physically it may not be possible. Whether one mom had had cancer, had a mastectomy done, so she can't breastfeed her child. So to put her in an environment and tell her breastfeeding is absolutely the best and the only way that their child will, you know, be healthier, most intelligent, I have a really hard time with that. Because again, through a lot of my mom's best efforts, they're trying their best and they're just not able to successfully breastfeed their child. So I always give a lot of them the scenario, I always refer to them that as, you know, physicians were thought to be fairly, you know, smart and intelligent, and that I always tell them if they'll stand a bunch of us in a room, they would never know who was breastfed or who was formula fed. So again, if it works for them, you know, great, and I'm here to support them. If it doesn't, that's okay too. Babies will be just fine.
In our news meeting, when we were talking about what has changed with babies, the subject was washing babies, and specifically that it's getting longer and longer after our baby is born for their first bath. So talk about that a little bit.
Part of it is with the cord. So the umbilical cord, we encourage the parents not to submerge their belly button or where that cord is until it's fallen off. And the concern is that if their belly button's underneath the water, that it will have water, you know, remain in there, potential for infection, things like that. The other thing is that the infant has been in a water environment for a long time, and then now they're outside. And if there's frequent washing or regular washing, that it will further irritate the skin or dry out the skin. And the skin is very sensitive in those first couple of weeks. What I always tell parents is, you know, about every 2 to 3 days or so to do it. And just to be prepared for the fact that they will shed and they will have, you know, the kind of flaky skin. And no matter how much they apply lotion to other stuff, it's just a very normal process and that the child will go through. And also that they're going to have a variety of rashes. And so I always encourage them to let me know if they have concerns and talk to them about them.
Speaking of parents, sometimes for some people, it can be a little bit of a whirlwind when you have a new baby in your house. So we've been talking about the baby. Let's talk now about mom and dad just for a moment. Give them a little piece of advice of what they can do to take care of themselves.
Great question. So I always encourage my moms when I see them, whether it's the father or another parent or a friend, whoever's going to be their support person, that they have someone for support and that they remember kids are meant to cry. Their only ability as a newborn to tell us when they want something is to cry. And long term, they won't remember it. So again, if they've fed them, if they've changed their bottom, if they've burped them, they've done everything they can, it's okay to lay them in their pack and play or lay them in their bassinet or crib, and they might just need to cry. And most of them will either figure it out, they'll either stop, they'll fall asleep, or then, and I tell the parents, go outside or go somewhere for 15 minutes, take a break, and then come back, and you will feel refreshed, and then you'll be able to figure it out. But that's just, they all cry, and they're all going to be okay in the end.
That's right. Really good advice.
Bottom line, just let them cry.
Well, thanks for filling us in on the latest in newborn care, Dr. Allen. Dr. Summer Allen is a specialist in family medicine at Mayo Clinic. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
That's our program for this week. For more information about topics discussed today, visit us on the web at Mayo Clinic News Network, where you can access a podcast of today's show, previously aired programs, and the latest news from Mayo Clinic. For more information, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network for today's podcast and previously aired programs. Find more information on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. Tweet us your health and medicine questions anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or email us at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. We may answer your question during an upcoming program. Have a question about health and medicine for one of our Mayo Clinic experts? Tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. We'll be answering your questions in upcoming programs.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. A writer for the program is Rich Dietman. Our social media editor, Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.